Greetings, this is Nigeria Anderson, you with UrbanBuzzMag.com, and I have Sean Edwards on the line with me. He's a producer, he's a film critic, and I'm so interested in talking about that, and has done a lot of things, worked on projects like Traffic, the film Black and Blue, and The Intruder. Sean, say hello to the people, and let's start the conversation.
What's going on, people? yeah. What's going on, people out there who watch all these movies and TV series that I talk about? Yeah, I'm letting y'all know if it's good, if it's bad, or in between, but it's been a heck of a career.
I love it. Now, that position, film critic, holds weight. I mean, we all know, I'm going to tell my age right now. We all know when Roger Ebert said, go see the movie, we took his word for it, you know, and we went running mm-hmm. out to go see it. And then, you know, he was pretty accurate, you know. Now, I think they have the Rotten Tomatoes and how many Rotten yeah. Tomatoes you get. But having an honest opinion now in this day of social media can be dangerous, even about a film. So how do you add value and worthy opinions about the films you review?
Well, you know what? You brought up a good point. The art of film criticism, which is a form of journalism, has been tremendously diluted because of social media, because now anybody can go on X or Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or YouTube and say whatever they want to say about a movie. Traditionally, you know, film critics came through the ranks of going to journalism school or going to film school and sort of being validated that sort of way. And then, you know, you branched out into writing, or you went on the radio, or you went on the television. But you can still be relevant today as a film critic because it's called building trust
right.
with your audience. So I've been on television for 25 years. And so when, you know, when people watch television, it's one of the most intimate things you do. Because when you turn on your television either like in your living room, your bedroom, your family room, your kitchen. Some people have televisions in their bathroom. So you're technically, you are, when you watch me on TV, you are inviting me into your home.
Right.
And when you invite someone into your home, you have a different level of trust, a different level of respectability, a different level of credibility. So
right.
The things I say when I'm reviewing a movie or a TV series on my segment on the news, I believe holds more weight than me as a miscellaneous person just typing on my phone and tweeting something out or posting something on Instagram or making some stupid video on YouTube, because you just have not been validated.
Right. Oh, that was excellent. That was excellent. Now, you've done some other production work in films, like I mentioned, Traffic, Black and Blue, and
yeah.
The Intruder. How did you come about getting involved in those film projects?
Well, I mean, that's how I got started as a film critic, because initially growing up as a kid, you know, I was enamored by movies and the whole filmmaking process. I was basically self-taught as a 7 or 8 year old by checking out books about how movies are made and going to the camera store and buying a Super 8 millimeter camera and just making my own movie. So I always thought,
wait a minute, you talking too fast. Did you just say
okay,
Super
right.
8? Did you just
you said
did,
what?
Did you just say Super 8?
Yeah, I'm old. Yeah. You
okay.
Know,
no. I wanted to pause on Super 8 because I don't even think these people understand what that means. I had to pause because, you know, I went to NYU film
cool.
school, and I
okay.
had to edit real film, not
yes.
digital,
yeah. Yeah.
real film. And you could not yeah. mess up. You could not cut the wrong piece and then try to have to splice it back together. Okay, this is for our film crew. This is for people in who know about real film. Okay. All right,
yeah.
Sean, I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Real
I'm sorry.
Real
it's your
film.
Interview. Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, you make a good point, like, because, so I don't think people understand. You also, like, today, you can just have a phone and you can just
yes!
shoot all day. When,
yes!
when you're shooting on film, man, those Super 8 cartridges, math, if you were efficient,
right.
you're going to get about 3 minutes. 3 minutes at the most. So you, and then you got to block everything, set everything. Everything's got to be correct.
Yes.
And then you shoot. And then here's the killer. This was no one under 40 understands.
Come on.
You go and shoot all of this. You don't know what you shot until 2 or 3 weeks later. because you have to send the cartridge. You gotta take the cartridge out of the camera, get in your car or on the bus, go to the camera shop. I was in Kansas City, so they had to actually ship the cartridges to Chicago. So all the film got processed in Chicago. Then the lab in Chicago sends your film back to Kansas City, and then they call you on the landline that your reel is back. Then you go pick it up. Then you go find
Sean.
Out whether or not.
Tell them. Then you find
out whether or not what you shot is good. Yeah, because you put it on the viewfinder, and then you have to watch it by hand. Because you load it up, and you have to crank in the thing, making sure. And then, like you said, you got to physically cut the good parts out and, you know, throw the best. That's where, like, you know, the term, you know, the scene got hit the floor. Because
right.
The bad scenes, you take the film, you just drop it on the floor, then you spice everything together.
Yep.
And then here's what a lot of people don't know, man. The thing with Super 8 was adding sound was really hard. Like, you had to be, like, a really skillful filmmaker to add sound onto your film, because the sound strip ran on the left side of the film.
Can you tell them?
And so, like, if you were shooting a movie with dialogue, your actors had to be so good at it so that you could splice it together to where it makes sense, because you can't go back and read the it was real filmmaking.
It required,
we didn't have no iPhone, no laptop.
Yeah.
It was real filmmaking.
Right. It required skill. Okay.
Yes. It required skill. It required
focus.
Skill. Well, it required two things that are in short supply in 2026. It required skill, and it required patience.
Yeah, and focus. You had to be focused.
And focused.
Yeah, you know.
And focused.
You couldn't be on your phone trying to edit Super 8.
Well, we didn't have phones back then,
so we were
not distracted by it. We were not. I actually think that's what's wrong with society. We are. You got a billion people on the planet, and they're all distracted.
Yes, say it. Say it. That was perfect. They are distracted to the point where, are they even going to the movies anymore?
Well, that's a whole different thing. There are a lot of guilty culprits in the reasons why people don't go to the movies. But I will start with one that people don't talk a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why a lot of people don't go to the movies, particularly Black people, is because the theater companies that build the movie theaters that show the films don't build any of those multiplexes in our neighborhoods.
Mm.
Like, I don't care if it's Kansas City, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. Primarily, most of the multiplexes that were built by AMC, that were built by Cineplex, that were built by these theater exhibition companies, are all in the suburbs.
Mm.
So you want me, I live in the middle of the city here in Kansas City, so you asking me to drive, every time I want to see a movie, I got to drive 15, 20 miles to see a movie?
Right.
How come I can't go right down the street? How come I can't go downtown? How come I can't go right around the corner to see a movie?
Mm-hmm.
So you have incentivized me to say, hey, I'm just going to watch this movie on my television.
Right.
Because it's a lot easier for me to grab my remote, sit on my couch, and I got food and drinks and and have a good time watching this movie. Because you built all your multiplexes outside of my neighborhood. I'm tired of driving outside of my neighborhood to go and watch a movie where you're going to overcharge me for the concession.
Right.
You're going to have workers that don't really understand me. So 9 times out of 10, I get treated rudely. And you got customers who live out by that place who don't really want me out here.
Right.
Like, why go here?
Right.
So that's part of the equation that doesn't get talked about a lot. To why people, particularly Blacks and Hispanics, have said, look, man, we're just not going to the movies anymore because we feel a lot better. We feel a lot safer by watching this movie at home. Like, because if I drive 20 miles to the suburbs, then, you know, you rolling the dice on getting pulled over by the cops.
Right.
You know, there's too many negative things that can happen. It's just a lot easier and a lot safer to watch stuff at home. And, you know, the industry, they don't talk about this, but AMC invested all their multiplexes in these suburbs.
Wow.
And they're paying the price for that. They're paying the price for that right now.
Okay. And also, what films are really trying to appeal to us that really have value that we want to be entertained? You know?
None.
Right.
None, which is why platforms like Tubi, YouTube are exploding, because you have young black filmmakers that can get their movies shown on these platforms, and that's what, you know, certain audiences are looking for. Like, no, Hollywood is not in the business of producing films that appeal to black people. They just aren't.
Right. Now, you worked with
That's not their business. It's not their business model. Plus, you don't have any black people in the room, and you don't have any black people with the power to say, make this movie, and you don't have any black people that have the money that it takes to finance the movie. When you have the money, but you look like the other folk, you're going to give your money to stories that appeal to you. You're not going to give your money to stories that appeal to black men and black women and black children, because that ain't you, and it's your money, and you do what you want to do with your money, and you're allowed to do that. But that's why there's a lack of content for black people, because we don't have the money that it takes to produce these films and produce these television shows. And we're not working at the studios at executive levels that can greenlight projects or give projects finance that appeal to us. We're not at the top shelf of Warner Brothers and Paramount and Netflix and all these companies. We're just not. There's nobody in these studios and streamers that call them big shots.
Right. I mean, just look at the bidding war. I mean, $108 billion for Warner Brothers? I mean, my mind... My mind can't comprehend. I'm like, what?
No, your mind should comprehend. You know why? Because they're telling you loud and clear. There's a value to content, because whoever controls the content controls the imaging and the messaging.
And the narration.
And that's worth more than that bid price.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I know that there's an issue with black and brown people in entertainment. I want us to really stop trying to be part of Hollywood and be independent like the Oprahs and the Tyler Perrys. And what hurts me, and the Robert Johnsons, because those are all the three I know that I was very pleased with.
Yeah.
And I'm always baffled. Like, I'm like, why we don't just come together? Just all come together. They come together. They haven't been wars of merging. Universal and NBC, everybody coming together, and they already got money. So what is the problem, Sean? Do you know?
If I could solve that problem, I would be on the level of a Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman. I don't have an answer. I don't understand it. I have a lot of issues with us as a people.
Me too.
I don't understand it. I don't get it. But when it comes to entertainment, I'm not sure why we don't pool our money or resource our money together. You know, it's baffling, and I do not have the answer.
All right. Moving on. You're part of the co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association that launched in 2003. Talk about that a little bit. What gave you that idea to just launch?
It's sort of like your story, where you say, you know, you had a job interview at a mainstream publication and they wouldn't hire you, and then they proceeded to tell you you don't know anything about, you know, black entertainment. Gil Robertson and I, you know, started this because there were a handful of blacks that were working as film critics at the time. And I was in the Kansas City Film Critics Circle. It was like 35 members, primarily all white men over 40. I'm the only black person there. And I found that being in that organization, my voice got drowned out. I'll never forget, you know, at the end of the year, we always come together in person to vote on the best films of the year and the best performances of the year. And it was kind of like a round robin situation where you bring up a name and you toss it out there. And I remember I got into a huge argument. I believe it was over a performance. There was a film that, you know, DMX was in, and I was just, you know, making a point that I said, man, this performance is actually pretty good.
Right.
Take away the fact that DMX is a rapper, take away the fact that he's part of the hip hop community. That performance was like at least worthy to be put on the floor to be voted on. And it was just a big argument. And I'm like, I'm not doing this. I was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not doing it. Because the problem I had, too, is like, out of the 35 members at the time, you know, I was you know, arguably I was the most high profile.
Right.
Like, I was on television every day. Like, nobody worked for, you know, no disrespect, but you had people working for community papers and people that were damn near hobbyists at it. I'm like, I'm a professional. I'm on television every day.
Right.
Like, what are we doing here? So I was like, I'm not doing it. And so I found that the few other Black film critics that were working at the time were in similar situations. And so I went to Gil Robertson and we said, look, man, let's just start our own situation.
Nice.
And that's what we did. We sat down and wrote out the details on a napkin at a hotel bar and, you know, took it from there. And here we go. 23 years later, it's, you know, one of, not just Black, but one of the most influential film critic groups in the world. So it's, you know, that's the thing. When you don't want to be a part of something like, you know, Tyler Perry, he told me this in person, but he's also said it in some of his speeches. Stop asking for a chair at the table.
Come on.
Just build your own table. Build your own table. And that's what we did with AFTA. We built our own table, then we built our own chairs, and then we filled those chairs with quality people, and we made a statement.
Salute to you and your partner, and thank you for that, because we need more voices.
Yes, absolutely.
What's one of your favorite 70s films?
You don't put me on the spot like that.
Sure not.
You do know that the 1970s is the
greatest
decade for film. The 70s is the greatest decade for film.
Yes.
Like, not just Black film, but just film in general.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. I grew up during the 70s. Oh, wow.
Your top three. Do your top three.
Okay. I got to do my top three because the first two I got to represent films that were introduced to me by my parents. So, you know, my dad, you know, he introduced me to, you know, Shaft, Superfly. But I'm going to go, the first one is Shaft, though. And the reason why, not only did that movie blow me away, because, you know, you have really never seen characters move that way, talk that way, dress that way. I mean, it was mind-blowing. But Gordon Parks, prolific. He's from Fort Scott, Kansas. He also advocated for Blacks working behind the scenes on that film. And then you had that incredible score by Isaac Hayes. I mean, it's such a compelling film and a compelling story. So I go Shaft. And then my mom introduced me. One of her favorite films was Claudine, starring Diane Carroll.
I still watch that
today.
Which
is still one of the greatest love stories. Yeah, still one of the greatest love stories ever. You know, Diane Carroll, James Earl Jones, just the situation that she's in as a single mom, trying to raise six kids and then still have a, you know, some sort of love life and come together to make the situation better. But it was just done so realistically. That movie also has a very underrated soundtrack.
That soundtrack is crazy.
Oof.
I still listen to the soundtrack.
Oof. No. It's still very listenable in 2026. I mean, that soundtrack is fire. And then if I had to pick a third film, you know, I'm gonna go with Michael Schultz's Coolie High, just because that's the film that represents like how we grew up. It represents the neighborhood. It represented friendship, and it had a very strong and powerful message. And in the ending, just the ending, I still can't watch that. I like, I know what's going to happen.
I know
what's going to happen. Like, it's like, damn, I can't get through the ending. If I started watching that movie right now, I can't get through it. I cannot. That's just how dope it is, though. You know everything that's going to happen, but I still can't get through it. So I'll go Shaft, Claudine, Coolie High, you know. But there's so many other classic films in the 70s. I mean, that's the decade. That's the decade for movies. That's the decade for music.
Yeah, for sure. When you watch Coolie High, one of my old films that I still get like, oh my goodness, is Imitation of Life. When she starts saying, Mama! Mama! Yeah. I'd be like, why?
That movie's deep.
Yeah,
That movie cuts. Imitation of Life, that movie cuts deep.
Yeah.
I mean, we still dealing with them same issues in 2026.
See what I'm saying? That's why I brought it up. I said, I can't stand when I watch a film and I'm like, and ain't nothing changed from this date
crazy.
Today.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know, another movie where it's just, nothing has changed at all. It's like, Do the Right Thing. It's like, it's crazy. Like, not a damn thing has changed.
That's what makes me sad.
Well, it makes you sad, but it also demonstrates the genius of these filmmakers.
Right.
Like, to have your pulse on the culture in a way that what they created has functioned as this time capsule and this microcosm of this country and society that we live in is just like, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It's sad.
It is.
But artistically, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They definitely capture the story correctly. Yeah. Now.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
We talked about film. Let's go on with TV. How do you feel about reality TV?
Reality TV is stupid. I lump reality TV in with social media because, to me, reality TV is wasted energy. You know, why are we wasting this energy to tear one another down?
Right.
To expose dirty laundry. Like, why, you know, there's so many other stories and things we can do. Stories to tell and things to talk about. It's wasted energy.
Okay. What's your last film you watched in the 2000s that just ministered to you? You was like, oh, that was good.
The last film in the 2000s or the last film last year?
I'm going to say in the 2000s, but if you have one in the last year, go ahead and share with us.
Cool, but I will say this. The movie that, for the 2000s means the last 26 years.
Yeah.
I'm still blown away. I saw an early cut of the movie before it had even end credits on it. So I wasn't swayed by the way that it just galvanized the culture.
Uh-huh.
But I was just really struck by Get Out.
Okay.
With what Jordan Peele did with that film and the story he told.
Yeah.
It was really thought provoking. I remember I way before it was coming out, you know, I remember a representative from Universal called me and it was like, "We got something you wanna see." You know, they often do that, particularly with black films. So they called me and said, they didn't tell me what it was. They were just like, "Yeah, we're gonna set up this screening for you at such and such a theater at such and such a time." So, you know, I get to the theater, sit down in there by myself. You know, it gets dark, which is really weird when you're in a big multiplex by yourself. It's dark, about to watch a film. So then the movie just starts playing and I'm watching and I'm like, you know, at the time, Jordan Peele was really, like, he was only known for the sketch comedy show,
exactly.
Key and Peele. He was not known. He wasn't known as a filmmaker.
Right.
At all. Right. You know, he wasn't a thing yet. You know, so I'm watching this film play out and it just, you know, it hit me, you know, on so many levels and it, you know, it still holds up. I love movies that hold up over time and it still holds up over time. So that's the one film in the 2000s that just really took me to a different place and hit me in a different way.
Okay. All right. And anything current?
I mean, yeah. Can't Stop Talking Enough, and we shouldn't stop talking enough about Sinners. Like, Sinners is such an amazing film because Sinners is the one thing that a lot of black people complain about because black people struggled with movies about the past, particularly during the slavery Jim Crow era. So I don't want to watch any more movies about slavery. I don't want to watch any more movies about segregation. I don't want to watch any more movies about racism. Well, Sinners was able to do all of that and get people to like it and galvanize people. Like, it was like, it's like Ryan Coogler put sugar into medicine.
Right.
Because the movie is, the messaging of the movie is a direct link back to slavery. It takes place during the Jim Crow era. It's all about racism. It's all about segregation.
Right.
I mean, there's a beautiful scene in the movie that doesn't get talked about a lot that directly focuses on segregation. There's this scene where one of the twin brothers, they go to the Asian store. And if you notice in that scene, there's an Asian store for the black folks, and you go across the street, and there's an Asian store for the white folks.
Mm.
I mean, if you watch that, the camera does this flip where, you know, it's all black on the left-hand side, and the camera flips, and it's all white on the right-hand side.
Right.
It's such a powerful juxtaposition of cinema that has really gone primarily unnoticed in the film. But I like little tricks like that that Ryan Coogler did in that film to really talk about the injustices that have happened to black folks in America. And it's also one of the first films that has really given blues its proper respect, given blues the flowers to talk about. You know, everything that we listen to, you know, it comes from the blues. The blues are the origins of American music, which came over the bases of which came over on the slave ships, and you know, from the blues, you got all this other music, including rock and roll, including country music, including hip hop, including all that, with that incredible, you know, montage scene that takes place in the juke joint. That just, the first time I saw it, I literally wish I had a remote control. So like, what did I just see? And I need to see it again. I was like, what did I just witness? And I need to see it again. So I don't think we can not talk enough about, you know, we should keep talking about Sinners, because the thing that I learned, particularly from studying film in school and just from, like, just reading and researching film, is what the mainstream does is they tell you over and over again what's great.
Right.
And the reason why you believe these movies are great is because they tell you over and over again. Like, they're always reminding you, like, Citizen Kane is the best movie ever made. And then you watch it, I'm like, no, it's not. No, it's not. But because they tell you, they're like, Casablanca is the best movie ever made. No, it's not. I watched it. My eyes worked, and I wear glasses. I've been wearing glasses since I was four. My vision's perfect. I just watched it. It's not one of the greatest movies ever made. Gone with the Wind, the best movie ever made. No, it's not.
Right.
But the reason people believe that is because they tell you over and over again, like the American Film Institute will put out the list of the 100 greatest films. They're constantly reminding you, Citizen Kane, Casablanca, Gone with the Wind, you know, all these films that we don't connect with. I'm like, you know, where's Claudine? Where's Claudine?
Where's Sparkle?
Where's Coming to America? Where's Sparkle? Where's Black Caesar?
Right. Like, where's Wakanda? Where's Black Panther?
Exactly. And so, you know, that's the power they have over us, because they control the mediums.
Wow.
They control television. They control radio. They control the publication. So they tell you over and over again, you know, this is the best. This is the best. This is the best. And you're like, wait a minute. You know, you feel some kind of way because you know that's not the type of movies you watch with your family. That's not the type of movies you watch when you went on a date.
Right.
That's not the type of movies you're going to pull up on your TV when you just got some downtime on a Saturday. You're not watching that stuff. You're watching other stuff. And that stuff is great. But they never tell you that that stuff is great. So you don't believe that stuff is great. It's kind of like the white doll versus the black doll test.
Right.
Why do kids always pick the white doll? Because you've been told that white is great. White is better. White is this. It's the same thing with film. You've been told Citizen Kane is this. Casablanca is that.
Right.
Gone with the Wind is that. You've been told Shaft is bad. Superfly is negative.
Right.
Coming to America is not funny. And so then you believe it. But you know it's not true.
Yeah. I was watching Eddie Murphy's documentary. And I didn't realize he never won an award as an actor.
Can I say something about that?
Absolutely. We are where key players speak, honey. You can talk talk.
Yeah, no. Eddie, you're correct. Eddie Murphy has never won an Oscar. But guess what? He got to get in line because Ozzy Davis never won an Oscar.
Oh.
Ruby D. Never won an Oscar.
Right.
Diane Carroll never won an Oscar. Cicely Tyson never won an Oscar.
Right.
Angela Bassett has never won an Oscar. Lawrence Fishburne has never won an Oscar. Samuel L. Jackson has never won an Oscar. Right? So he had a long line.
Yeah, but they haven't. I understand what you're saying, but he's produced a lot and have done a lot. And I'm not saying he deserves it over them.
I'm not saying he's not deserving.
I'm just saying
He for damn sure should have won an Oscar for Dreamgirls. Like, I don't know what that was about.
Right.
I don't know. He for damn sure should have won for Dreamgirls. I would have given him the Oscar for Coming to America.
Right.
So I've met every working actor in Hollywood the past 25 years, and not narrow one of them could do what he did in The Nutty Professor and play 5 or 6, 7 roles, all distinctly different and unique. There's nobody on the planet that can do that.
Yeah.
You know? But Michael Jordan was great. He played 3 in Sinners, but Michael Jordan can't do 5 or 6 or 7.
Right. And so my point is, and I'm glad you ran down the list of those, like you said, get in line. Again, I'm just saying we're going to have to do better if we're going to be in this entertainment business, that we as African Americans. I like saying black people, but you know, to be politically correct,
it's black people.
Me too. I always be like, I'm black. I don't know, but African Americans.
Yeah, black. Black.
Right.
African American was always a weird. African American was always weird phrasing.
Yeah.
You don't call black people from England, African, British or whatever. They're black people.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It was weird. It was weird. We're black.
Right, and especially if you grew up in the '70s, like that whole "say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud."
Yeah,
so I'm black forever.
100%. Say it loud, I'm black and proud.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. I'm praying that we get better, do better. And if you're listening to this wonderful conversation I'm having with Sean, with two vets that's in the business that know what it is for real, and the behind the scenes real for real, support. First of all, we have to start supporting our films, whether we like it or not. Now, I know that people are probably just like gasping for air, but the one thing I don't like is if you don't like it, just don't watch it again. But at least give it a shot. You know, we're never gonna get anywhere if we keep just devaluing our time and quality as creatives. We know the sacrifice. And it looks like 5 minutes, 10 minutes when you look at it, or 30 minutes or an hour. But the work that goes behind it is something that needs to be valued. And I don't think we value the time and the work that goes into the projects that we do. Now, Sean, are you interested in making a film?
Oh, yeah, I would love to. I mean, I've dabbled. I've produced a couple of documentaries. We did a series of four documentaries on the history of black film 2 years ago now, back in the early 2000s. So, yeah, I would love to. I got some stories I want to tell. So I'm actually moving in that direction. So, it's something that I'm really keenly interested in doing. But, like I mentioned early in the conversation, the financing aspect of producing film is extremely difficult.
Right.
I speak at schools often, and I tell young students that are supremely gifted, super talented, that, you can have the best idea in the world. You can write the perfect screenplay. You can be the best director. You can be the best actor. You can have all those attributes, but if you don't have the money, you can't get anything done.
Okay, so what about the whole new AI situation where they're saying you can make films now using AI, and they got these?
No, it's bad. That's super bad. That's when we're not going there. That's AI is what I like to call the job killer.
Right.
It's further isolating us. Now, we're already isolated enough.
Right.
We don't have to go. We don't have to go to the grocery store anymore.
Right.
We can't go to a Blockbuster and pick out movies while other people are choosing movies. We can't go to the record store and hold the album anymore.
Come on,
we don't go to the mall and shop together. We're ordering everything online. I mean, AI is a further tool to isolate us, which is going to lead to the downfall of humanity.
But in the process of it now producing music and film, I'm so sensitive, jeez. But what bothers me is that then these organizations give it, like you said, their stamp of approval. Oh, this new song just won a Grammy and it's generated by AI. Stop it. Stop it right now.
I don't think a song produced by AI has won a Grammy yet. We haven't crossed those waters yet.
If they're talking about it, it soon comes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong. I don't hate AI because there are some useful aspects of AI. I just would not like to see AI used to create film and TV shows. I don't want to replace working actors. I don't want to replace working writers. I don't want to replace working directors. And, when you watch a movie and you see the end credits and you see all those names, the average time length of end credits on a movie is about 5 to 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
All those names are actually people that are working.
Right.
Those are people to get, paychecks so they can buy groceries and pay the mortgage and put kids through college and buy clothing and cars. I mean, we do not want to kill those people's jobs.
I don't think it will, because I think there's a real distinct difference between us and them, if that works. I guess that'll work. And I believe us will win in the end. And I think AI may be the disruptor needed to unite us in our gifts and creative, our creative gifts, for us to actually really then sit, pause, and think and say, man, that's good, because only we understand each other. So we have a language, we have a movement, we have a rhythm that only we understand. And I think the disruption may just be what we need to say, hey, high five, we did this, we got this done. So Sean, I thank you so much for rocking with me today and just talking film. I love it. I could do this all day.
Yeah, this has been a great conversation.
Anything that I left out, please chime in. Let the people know anything you have coming up, or is there?
I will add one thing that is fairly important. Like, currently, I'm working on a massive project. We're actually building the first ever Black Movie Hall of Fame in Kansas City, Missouri. It'll be located in a movie theater we're renovating called Boone Theater. It was originally built in 1924. It's located in the 18th and Vine Historic Jazz District, and it will open at some point this year in 2026. So we're really excited about that, because it's going to be a home where we not only preserve the legacy of Black film, but we will educate people about Black film and entertain people with Black film projects, and, you know, give all the people in front of the camera and behind the camera, it'll be a place where, you know, they get their flowers, where they get talked about, you know, right, where people can see their very, very important legacy. Because what a lot of people don't realize is Black people have been making movies since Hollywood first started making movies. And we're going to talk about it. Right. And we're going to celebrate it. And we're going to salute those who are out there on the front lines doing what they do, so they can tell these stories about the Black experience and show them in movie theaters. So that's the whole goal of the Black Movie Hall of Fame. So we've been working really hard, raising some more money. We were able to raise $12 million for the building. Now Wow. We got to raise some more money for the inside. So we got it going. We're getting it going, but it will open in 2026.
How can people help? Do you have a page to donate somewhere where?
We do. Just go to blackmoviehalloffame.com. If every Black person in America gave us just $1, man, we rocking and rolling. You know, every dollar helps. $5 helps. We're not asking for a lot, but it's all tax deductible. Black Women Hall of Fame Foundation is a not-for-profit, so if you're generous and able to give, you know, a substantial amount, it's definitely tax deductible. You can also, Black Movie Hall of Fame on all social media platforms. We're keeping people updated. That's where you can find out about the project. That's where you can go and donate. It's going to open in 2026 in Kansas City, Missouri. BlackMovieHallOfFame.com. It's where we're going to, like, protect the legacy of Black filmmaking, salute Black filmmakers, and just introduce the world to these pioneers that have been out there doing it for more than 100 years.
Excellent. I'm so excited about this. It just made me feel so joyful inside, because it's definitely needed. And so salute mm-hmm. to you and your mm-hmm. team being the forerunners of this. I appreciate y'all for that. And definitely invite me out. I want to come out. And I will donate.
Definitely. You will be the first. You'll be the first person we invite out. We're going to have a big gala on February 27th, 2027. So,
okay.
Yeah, we definitely want you to come to Kansas City and we'll hang out. I'll keep you posted.
All right.
We got a newsletter. I'll make sure you get the newsletter. You'll get all of that.
So, all right.
I'm excited.
I appreciate it. Listen, as we like to say, once a key player, always a key player. So as you continue to prosper in all the things that you're doing that are great, especially for us in the film and entertainment business, Sean, thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
No, thank you. Thank you. This is a great conversation. It's a great way to start the day. Great way to start the day.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
No, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Have a good rest of the day, and God bless.
You too. All right.